Hey, welcome back to Endpoint TV. This is your host, Ron Jacobs, and today I'm joined by international man of mystery, Byron Tardif. And we were just talking, Byron, you went to school in different...
My heritage is kind of complicated. I grew up in Mexico City.
Yeah.
I went to school there, but I also did international programs in Dublin, Ireland, and in Budapest, Hungary.
Wow, that's cool, man. Okay, so what are you working on now?
So I'm working in App Fabric, Windows Server App Fabric,
mm-hmm.
and in particular, I work in the area of setup and configuration. So I am the man that deals with the first impression of the product.
Yeah, so important. And you know, it's funny, we were talking earlier how setup is often the thing of just like, at the last minute, somebody goes like, oh, we have to have a setup here, and you know... it's the thing that gets kind of shortchanged and all that. So today, here's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about what it's like to download and set up AppFabric Beta 2.
Right.
And a lot of people have heard about AppFabric, never really got their hands on it yet. But Beta 2 is great. You can get it. It's really reliable, and you can get it and work with it. So we want to show them a couple of different scenarios. So tell me about the first one.
So the first one we're going to show is the scenario for people who are... you know, just getting to know AppFabric. Let's say you're a developer, you have Visual Studio on your box, you already have probably some .dovcf services built on .NET 4.0, but you want to know what AppFabric is giving you.
Right.
So this would be like the ideal way for you to start.
Okay.
And what some of the good things that we do with this is we are integrating to WPI, which is the Web Platform Installer.
Which is totally awesome.
Right.
It's a
sweet, sweet product.
Yeah.
And The greatness of this is that you don't have to worry about prereqs.
Right.
We know what you need. We go and check the box for you. We figure out what you have installed, what's the right version, what needs upgrading, what needs updating.
Yeah.
We chain all the installations.
Yeah.
So you basically just click a button, set it, wait.
Uh-huh.
After a couple of minutes, it's going to be done, and then you're ready to go.
That is really awesome, and it's way, way better than the traditional setup experience. Where I remember many years ago installing Microsoft Transaction Server. Okay, this was a long time ago. And there was like this certain funky order, like, you know, you had to install NT, then you had to install this patch, and then you had to install the option pack and do it in this certain way. Anyway, it was a big hassle. We are way beyond that now. Okay, so look, if you want to try this, go to Microsoft.com/web and
right.
you can get the Web Platform Installer. This is painless. In fact, you're going to show us how painless this is.
We're going to go through the process and...
All right, let's do it.
We'll talk about it. So the first thing is we're located in the Enterprise tab.
Okay.
This is the application server.
Right.
At the moment, we're the only product there, but this is eventually going to have other products.
Okay.
It's still not clear what's going in there, but there's been talk about, for example, SharePoint Designer, those types
right.
of things.
Okay.
Right? So I'm going to select Windows Server App Fabric. This actually gives you a little bit more detail on what it is.
Okay.
And when I click install, the first thing that it does, it's went through, looked at the computer,
right.
figured out what are the prerequisites that I'm missing. So in this case, I already have Visual Studio 2010 RC installed on this box. So I'm only missing a couple of things.
Okay.
In this case, some Windows components, and then there is the AppFabric setup. And the AppFabric configuration.
Cool.
So this is all done for you.
Now, in fact, AppFabric does not require Visual Studio,
right.
but it does require .NET 4.
Right. It does require .NET 4. And for this particular version, we're looking for the RC.
Okay. And if you didn't have .NET 4 on your machine, it would go ahead and add it?
Right. It would tell you that you're missing that, and it's part of the process.
Awesome. Okay.
So the other thing about this is that it lets you accept the ULS for all of this thing in one go.
That's
so
nice.
You just say, I accept once, and the process starts. So what it's doing right now, it's going to start downloading all the different bits that you need.
Right.
Some of them are already on the box because they're Windows components that you just need to turn on.
Right.
But for AppFabric in particular, you need to at least download AppFabric, right?
Right.
So while it's doing that, it's also starting with the installation process for the other components.
Okay.
So you don't have to wait for everything to download.
Right.
As soon as you have the first piece on your box, it can start with that. And also takes care of the intelligent chaining, which is which component should I install first and which component should come next. And it does all that
beautiful.
For you.
Okay, so while we're waiting on this, let's talk a little bit about some of the ways in which App Fabric is going to alter your box here when you install it. Okay,
right.
So I noticed it's doing some IIS stuff now. Tell me about how does it interact in IIS?
So for this particular scenario, we're talking about a developer scenario. So we need to make sure that there's some pieces there. For example, the added manager, mm-hmm. because we need the manager, because that is where our plugins are going to fit.
Okay.
That is where the management experience of App Fabric lives.
Okay.
So for example, we need that piece. And because we're also assuming that you're using WPI for a developer scenario, we're taking some liberties and we're creating some configurations.
Okay.
So we're looking for example, SQL Express.
Yeah.
And we're going to create a dead database for you.
Ah.
We're going to create a database for monitoring. We're going to create a database for persistence.
Yeah.
And we're going to create a database for the caching configuration.
Oh, sweet. Okay.
So we take care of all that pain.
Yeah.
But we're also taking care of not leaving the machine in a state that is going to be security vulnerabilities or stuff like that. So
right.
we don't open any firewall ports. We don't make any changes to your running applications.
Okay.
Everything stays pretty much as is. So you can basically run the setup, have it all configured,
yeah.
but your current apps are not going to be affected at all.
Okay. So that's awesome. Now, okay, so it does also then require SQL Express, which you would obviously have if you put Visual Studio 2010
right.
Beta 2 on there, you would have it. But if you didn't, that's also available through WebPI, so it would
correct.
Go ahead and grab it and install it.
Right.
I love that. That is so cool. All right, so basically then after this thing is done, you're done, right? You're ready. You're ready to launch it. It's all
yeah.
good to go.
You're ready to start playing with it, and you have a configuration that knows works, that you know that it's going to work.
Dude, this was supposed to be a 30-minute show. That's not going to take 30 minutes. No, that's okay. That's okay, because I like that. Now, so I'm completely lost. I'm so flabbergasted by what's going on. I remember what I was going to say. This is Windows 7.
Right.
Right. So we did say the name of the product is Windows Server App Fabric.
Right.
But you can install it on Windows 7 for development.
Yeah,
right?
For development scenarios.
Okay.
And we also have down-level support, so you will be able to install it in Win 6, which means Vista and 2008.
Okay. But not XP.
Not XP.
Okay.
So
it's about time. Get off that thing. All right. So come on. Win 7 is totally awesome. All right. So, but that's cool because I know a lot of people want to do their development on Win 7. And then now you can also deploy this on Windows Server.
Right.
But you would use a different process, right? You wouldn't use the web platform installer.
Well, the web platform installer actually supports installing on web servers.
Right.
However, we're thinking that you're going to want to have a lot more customization.
Okay.
Right, you might want to have like several monitoring databases because you want to partition your applications.
Right.
So you want that flexibility. Not everybody's going to be happy with a completely automated process.
Okay.
So we have that additional experience, which is the traditional download, click next.
You got an MSI
install,
and all
right.
that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Because you know, and a lot of times, especially when people do go to put this into live production environments, they're going to have like an IT administrator guy do it, and you know, he may never have seen the web platform installer,
right.
and you know, so he wants to do it in a different way.
Right.
Okay. In that case, though, it's going to be a little more manual because you're going to have to set up things like the web server role, or the application server role. You
right.
have to just know what to do.
Well,
right?
All of those things are also taken care of by setup. Anything that is a part of Windows,
mm-hmm.
we handle automatically.
Oh, okay.
Anything that is outside of Windows, you need to handle, like, for example, the databases and all that.
Right.
Also, you mentioned there's more of a manual process.
Yeah.
That is true only if you choose to be a manual process.
Okay.
Because anything that we're doing here
yeah.
is actually done through a script.
Oh.
So even in WPI, we're leveraging all our scripting interface
yeah.
to do that configuration.
Sweet. So, okay. Now, one of the things you often get, like, on a setup experience is, before you run setup, make sure you do this, make sure you do that, blah, blah, blah. So what you're
right.
telling me that is either with WebPI or the MSI setup experience, you don't have that. It's kind of like I could take a plain old, I just installed Windows Server 2008 R2. I haven't done anything to it. I
right.
can run the MSI. It's going to be fine.
Well, we do have some prereqs.
Okay.
But we'll let you know up front.
Like, okay.
For example, we need .NET framework.
Okay.
So that's something that you're going to have to go install.
Right.
It's not on the box. For the case of SQL, you don't need to be running SQL on the box. You can be running it on a different box, or you know,
right.
you have a shared resource. So when you're doing configuration, you just point to it.
Okay. Yeah, because we expect, like, when people set up App Fabric for a production environment,
right.
Realistically, they're probably going to have a separate SQL Server box,
right.
and multiple App Fabric servers that are sharing the same monitoring and persistence stores, right?
Especially when it comes to things like, for example, the high availability or scale-out scenarios that we have for workflow,
right.
where there's the WMS feature, which is the workflow management service.
Yeah.
That thing really shines when you have multiple boxes
yeah.
and when you have a shared database, because it allows the load to be distributed and things like that.
Okay. So actually, that's a good point. Let's talk about some of the elements that get installed, because
right.
you mentioned one of the services that gets installed is called the workflow management service. Tell me about, what is that thing? What does it do?
Right. So the workflow management service deals with, as it says, it's specifically for workflows.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes care of two things, the durable timers
mm-hmm.
and instance resume. So when you have a workflow, you can have it persist to memory.
Okay.
Or you can have it persist to a data store.
All right.
In our case, we have the SQL data store, and this is one of the things that we take care of in the configuration for WPI.
Okay.
So we create that persistence database.
Right.
Then WMS, what it does, it looks at your configuration file.
Mm-hmm.
It looks at the applications or services that you have that are running workflows
right.
and have the specific tag of this is a workflow that needs to persist.
Okay.
And what it does is it pulls the database that application is connected to.
Yeah.
And it looks for workflows that are ready to run or that are in a state that is resumable.
Okay.
And so basically what you have is you have a workflow that is running on one box. For some reason, your box crashed or there's a disconnect in the network.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, that workflow instance dies, right?
Yeah.
But you have an instance that is saved on the database.
Yeah.
And that is work that can continue on another box.
Right.
So WMS, basically what it's doing is looking for those instances or looking for expired timers. Say, I want this workflow to continue at 12:30.
Right.
But then you don't care which box it's going to continue on, as long as the work continues.
So this is one of the main things that people have noticed, that you know, if you write a workflow that has, and very often workflows have timers that are pretty lengthy, like you
right.
know, every 3 days, wake up and do this, right? So you know, the server might reboot, you know, and several times maybe, you
right,
know,
right.
who knows what's going on with that thing, right? So we need something, some piece of code that's going to start up when the server starts. It's going to look in the database for, hey, is it that third day yet? Is it time? And, you know, then it will do this. So this workflow management
right.
service does it for you, which is something we didn't really have in a previous version of workflow.
Right.
So, which is why I often tell people, if you're doing workflows, you want App Fabric. There's just no question about it. The two go together, salt and pepper, and, you know, you want them together, right?
Right.
So, hey, I see that it's
yeah,
done.
Yeah, so this is done. As you can see, there's a progress report of everything that went down.
Uh-huh.
We're all green.
Good.
So that means we're done. So as you can see, the product is already installed.
Yeah.
And we can actually take a look at IIS and see.
Okay, so if you wanted to, afterwards, you're like, yeah, let me see. How can I know it's really installed? Let's see it. So the best way is to look in IIS Manager.
Yeah, I'm just going to bring up IIS Manager.
Okay. And this is, of course, a virtual machine.
Yeah, so, this is a virtual machine running on a remote box, so a little bit
okay.
of patience.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so there you see it right there, that we have an App Fabric dashboard and all that. It's right there. It's beautiful.
Right.
Okay, and so if I see this, I'm pretty confident things got installed correctly, right?
Correct.
I mean, I probably would have seen some problem otherwise, but things are running there. Okay. So let's see. There's one other service that runs when you install App Fabric, and that's
right. That is the Event Collector
event
service.
Collector. Okay.
And that one is the one that maps directly to the monitoring database.
Okay.
So you can choose to monitor certain events in your applications, and this is something that you don't have to write any special code for.
Okay.
It's simply the events get emitted.
Yeah.
And we just have a filter that you can customize, and you can, you know, there's some custom filters that are already built in, and that you can just scroll up or down, say, you know, highest level of monitoring or lowest level of monitoring.
Right.
Or you can create your own in the middle.
Yeah, yeah. So the event collector kind of sits there and listens to this stream of events that comes spewing out of event tracing for Windows.
Right.
And then it's going to gather them up on all of the servers in your farm, let's say. If you were sharing one monitoring database,
right.
It sends all of those into a common database so you can get a picture of what's happening on all my servers, right?
Right, right.
So that's an important piece and very, very useful piece. All right, so let's take a look at the MSI experience. So that's because it's got more options that we get to deal with, right? So
it's
let's look at that.
A little bit more involved. So.
Okay.
Okay, so now we switch to a different VM.
Okay.
This is actually running Windows 2008 R2.
Okay.
And what I have here is the setup package.
All right.
So this is the setup package that you would get from the download center.
Right.
And you basically start by double-clicking it.
Okay, here we go. Okay.
So this is the setup experience.
Uh-huh.
And the first thing is, obviously, you're going to have to accept the EULA if you want to go any further.
Okay.
Then comes the customer experience program. Because this is a beta version, this is pre-selected for you. We want to know about what is your experience with setup.
Right.
And
okay.
Then this is the general customer experience.
Okay.
Then comes the feature selection.
All right.
So we already talked a lot about the hosting features. This is the event collector,
right.
WMS. You also mentioned auto start.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing is the caching service and cache administration.
Okay.
That is the other part of AppFabric.
Right.
And this is what allows you to do distributed caching.
Okay.
So just for demonstration's sake, I'm going to select everything. And this also would be equivalent to what you get out of the box from WPI.
Oh, so it did install the cache features and everything.
It installs the cache features. It creates a configuration and creates a caching configuration database.
Okay. Great. Great.
So out of the box, this is what you get. However, you can still go after the fact and remove some features that you're not interested in.
Super. All right.
I'm going to click Next. And usually, I already have .NET installed in here.
Right.
Because we didn't want to go through the whole process.
Yeah.
So if you were missing any prerequisite, you would get here another page that is the platform validation page and lets you know anything like if you have a configuration file that is secured and not accessible by this user,
right.
Or if you have any sort of configuration issue, any sort of missing prerequisite, we'll let you know you're missing this. Here's where you go and get it.
Okay.
Just to make the process of discovering prerequisites a lot less painful.
Okay, cool.
Then this is what when we're telling you what's going on, which is we're enabling the application server role.
Uh-huh.
We're enabling IS Manager Console.
Right.
And we're installing our pieces of AppFabric.
Cool.
So I'm going to say install.
All right. So now you mentioned configuration files because the setup for AppFabric touches the machine.config, doesn't it?
Right. Machine.config and rootweb.config files.
Okay. So you're going to, well, of course, setup's going to have admin privileges anyway on the box, right?
Right.
So. But it's important to know that it does. So what kind of changes does it put into these config files?
So we're adding the registrations for example, the AutoStart providers. AutoStart is a concept that exists in IIS 7.7.
Okay.
And we're just adding one more provider.
All right.
That allows you to have that feature. Or we're adding the ETW, the event tracing for Windows configurations that allow you to have those different monitoring levels.
Okay. All right. So you don't need to be too paranoid. If you want, you can take a look at before and after or something, but it just makes a few changes there.
Right.
Okay. And you mentioned a third database for the caching, which I think is interesting. So we talked about there's a persistence database that gets created, a monitoring database. And the way that the caching service works is you have all these servers in your distributed cache cluster.
Correct.
And you want them all to look at the same configuration.
Right.
Right. Okay. So you have a couple options. What are they?
You can have an XML file that is basically hosted on a shared folder.
Okay.
Or you could have out-of-the-box SQL database.
Okay.
For all the databases that we mentioned, there's an extensibility model.
Yeah.
So people are welcome to come up with, you know, their provider for database X for monitoring and.
Right, right.
So you can grow it.
Okay, because people always say, "Do you have a provider for my brand of database?" And I say, "No, no, we don't." But it's pretty simple. There's just like you can create your own, and it's just right. A class. You have to create and implement a few methods, and you're good to go.
Yeah, it's a plugin model. So basically, and we even surface your plugins through our UI.
Ah, okay.
So it's a first-class experience all the way.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Yeah, all right. So so then for the cache cluster, we got this database that just basically has configuration information
right.
for the cache, and if you want to share it that way, or an XML file on
right.
a UNC share. Okay. Looks like we're done. I see that everything is green, looks like. We were right. successful. That's good news.
We're
okay.
green across the board, so that's good news. You can get
a detailed installation report. That's
right.
like a complete log of everything.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
happened.
Everything that happened, it's a very verbose log,
mm-hmm.
so you can go and see with detail what went right, what went wrong,
okay.
and help you debug the problems.
Excellent, excellent. And it says launch configuration tool, so we're
right.
going to see the config tool. Let's do that.
Right. So this is, again, something that you can do optionally, because you can also opt for the command line configuration, and you can have your own script that you would run at this point.
Right, right.
You know?
Okay, because everything you can do in this tool, you could also do with a PowerShell script.
Exactly.
Which I totally love that. All right, let's see it, though.
So we launched the configuration tool.
And this config tool, you can run it here at setup time, but you can also run it later whenever
right.
whenever you feel like
right.
you want
right.
to run it again.
So here you can change the customer experience program if you decide to. And then the first page is hosting services. This is what lets you select the configuration for your monitoring and for your persistence databases.
Okay.
So let's go ahead and configure both for monitoring and persistence.
All right, so the first thing we talked about, that event collector service.
Right.
So we see it's going to run under local service account.
Right.
Which is probably, for most cases, the right thing.
When you're running it against a shared database,
okay.
you're going to want to change that. You're going to change it to something that's going to have access to that database.
Right, okay, yeah. So if you're using Windows Authentication, you need an
right.
account that might have a domain account or something, maybe
right.
it could use it. Okay. And then you selected a monitoring provider.
Right. This is where the extensibility model comes in.
Okay.
If you do your plugin, we would surface your plugin as a list in the selection.
And you even have a little link to get help text on how to install,
right. how to install
additional
providers.
That's very cool. All right. So you have to configure the provider once you've
right.
selected it.
And that brings up this UI. Once again, this would be UI that is specific to the provider. So this
okay.
is something that you would have to build if you're building a custom provider.
Okay.
In our case, we have the one for SQL out of
SQL
the box.
SQL Server. Yeah. Okay.
So we want to do two things. We want to register the monitoring store,
uh-huh.
and we want to create the database.
So initialize monitoring store means create the database.
Right.
Okay. All right.
We're mapping it to initialize because it maps to the verb in PowerShell that you would be calling.
Okay.
So the reason why we have this is that if you get used to the UI,
yeah.
you can easily switch to the PowerShell.
Okay.
So, what's the PowerShell that I need to call? Initialize.
All right.
You're set.
So you need to either create or select a
right.
database.
So
right?
obviously you're going to make this decision based on this is the first box, this is the ninth box that I'm configuring,
okay.
right? Because if you already created a database once,
right.
you won't have to do that on every box.
Right, okay.
So in this case, I'm pointing to the local SQL Express, and
yep.
just going to call it monitoring DB.
Okay.
And here's where you configure the access to the database.
Okay.
So if you have a database that's already been created, you
yep.
wouldn't have to worry about this. If you're creating it for the first time, this is where you start thinking, oh, these are the guys that are going to have admin privileges. These are the
right.
guys that are going to be able to write events to the database. These are the guys that are going to be able to consult events to the database.
So this is important because what we're seeing here, when it says security configuration, the thing on the left are roles in the database.
Correct.
The thing in the box are security groups that were created during the install.
Right. These are the groups that we create during setup.
Yeah.
And they're local to the machine.
Okay.
However, when you choose to go off box, you would be, you know, choosing either the main group or a group that is replicated across the different boxes.
Okay. So just to reiterate, though, we've got administrators, readers, and writers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it is, some people are going to be like, wow, well, writers and administrators happen to be the same security group over here, administrators.
Right.
But you could have a case maybe where you want somebody to be able to write but not administer.
Right.
So you have that difference, right?
Yeah, we want to have that flexibility because when you're running it on a single box,
yeah,
administrators make sense for both.
Yeah.
However, when you're running it on a remote box, that's when it gets interesting, and that's when it makes more sense to select different groups for different roles.
Okay. And when there's also a SQL authentication
right.
option. So this is if you're using Windows Auth in the database.
In the database, right.
Right. And if you're not, if you're using SQL Auth, we're just going to get a username and password. Whatever for everything.
Right. And in that case, you need to take care of, you know, there's going to be a plain text username and password in your config, so you might want to take the additional step of encrypting it.
Okay.
Our runtime is able to understand encrypted config.
Okay.
However, this is something that you would have to do after the fact.
Oh, okay. Okay. Didn't know that. All right. So, you know, because I know a lot of times people, particularly in web environments where they, you know, they have it in a DMZ, they don't have a domain maybe in the DMZ,
right.
and they want to use SQL Auth and things like that. So,
right.
Okay.
But this is standard practice. You encrypt your configuration,
mm-hmm.
you decrypt it to write the to add configuration. So basically, encrypting it equals locking.
Okay.
So,
yeah. And is what tool do you use to do that?
Well, you use the tools provided by IIS.
Okay.
Because all of this is living in IIS config.
Right.
You're just...
Oh, okay. Okay. Gotcha. All right.
So
cool.
We're not inventing anything new here.
Yeah, that's great.
So when I click OK, the two actions are going to be performed.
We're going
to initialize the database, and we're going to register it.
And you said this window actually belongs to the provider.
Right.
So it's the provider that does these actions.
Right.
Right. So if you create your own provider, you will get the chance to do your own thing. Okay. That's why it says, you know, do you want to continue? Because, you know, normally in the wizard model, you kind of think of, you build up a whole bunch of stuff, and at the end, then you do it all.
Right.
But this is a case where it feels a little different.
Right. We're performing actions atomically.
Right.
But the other important thing to note is that none of this is destructive.
Okay.
So even if you initialize a database that's already been initialized,
yeah,
we're just looking for the structure. So we don't actually change any of the data inside.
Oh, so if the database already existed... And it was everything was cool.
Right.
You just go, well, it's already good to go.
Right.
So this doesn't. It's a very important point. This doesn't reinitialize.
Right.
Like a lot of times, if you know you're in a development environment, you're kind of testing. You get a bunch of junk built up in there. You want to like wipe it out. This is not going to do that.
This is not. Yeah.
Okay. You have to because I have a PowerShell script that does this. I put it on my blog. You have to actually delete. The persistence store and re-add it if you want to do that sort of thing, right? So
or you can clear all the records, right?
Yeah. Okay, that's true. All right.
So here we have, once again, the monitoring store was registered successfully. If you have any problem with this, the database was offline, whatever, here's where you would get the report of what happened.
So in this initialization also involves not only creating a database, but creating tables...
Right.
And stored procedures,
right.
Setting up the security and everything for it. So it's just a whole package, but again, it's done by the provider.
Right.
So if you want to use Brand X database, you got to write a provider that does all that.
Right.
Okay.
And like I keep coming back to this point, but anything that you're doing here, you can do in PowerShell.
Yeah.
And for this particular one, if you're not comfortable either with the UI
mm-hmm.
or with PowerShell, we also provide the scripts.
Okay.
So if you're a DBA, all you care about is the SQL scripts.
Yeah,
like, give me the SQL scripts.
Well, and very often they want to see them, if nothing else, right?
Because
they want to know what kind of stuff are you doing to my database, right? So they can see that.
Right.
Okay.
And if you remember when we had the feature selection, there's a piece that is just the administration for hosting services.
Right.
And this is what it would give you. It would give you the ability to initialize those databases.
Okay.
So if that's all you care about, you can get just that piece.
Ah, okay. Excellent.
So this takes us back to the UI, and now we have the persistence case.
Okay.
This is the configuration for WMS service.
All
it's the same story. If you're running on Localbox, then defaults are okay.
Yeah.
If you're pointing to a remote database, then you have to think a little bit about what groups you're going to be using, who's going to be playing the role of administrator, who's going to be playing the different roles.
So it might make sense to, if you were doing in a domain, you might make domain groups that were sort of similar, like writers and observers and administrators.
Right. We have, there's the setup guide.
Yeah.
And there's a section of that setup guide that is how to set it up for a farm.
Oh, okay.
So a farm is basically multi-machine shared databases.
Right.
And the recommendation there is you set it up within a domain and you create some domain groups, let's say the App Fabric administrators, the App Fabric writers, and their App Fabric users.
Okay.
And then you populate those groups with users.
Yeah.
And then you have those three things that you can replicate across your machines.
Okay. Now, and by the way, just to be clear, when we say, you know, like we say users of App Fabric, that means, it doesn't necessarily mean like if I write a WPF app, like a client app, and I log into that app, and that app calls a service that happens to be hosted in the App Fabric, I don't have to be a member of the App Fabric users group.
No,
what that means is, well, you tell me.
Well, that means basically under which identity the app pool is going to be running.
Okay.
Because the app pool is the one who's executing your code. It's the process behind the scenes that is running and is going to be sending the request to the other services or to the database.
So in IIS, you have the app pools.
Right.
The app pool is that ASP networker process that and that runs under an identity, and that's the identity that better be in one of these groups.
Right.
Okay.
In particular, in the users group, the users column.
Right. Okay. Good. All right.
So once again, we have the provider model, and I'm choosing the SQL provider for persistence. Now, what I want to note is that the two providers are different.
Right.
So the fact that you write a provider for monitoring doesn't mean that it's going to be used for persistence.
Okay.
Because they're very different things. For monitoring, you want to have something that is a database.
Yeah.
That is relational because you want to query against it.
Mm-hmm.
For persistence, you could have a provider that is a cache. You could have a provider that is a plain file.
Right.
Because all you care about is storing the...
be stored in whatever you want. Yeah. And so even though this says SQL, store provider, this is... That's not generic SQL. This is specific to SQL Server.
Right.
Okay.
We're still working on the namings.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'm going to click configure. As you can see, the
same kind UI of
is pretty much the same.
Uh-huh.
You have the two operations that you want to perform.
Yeah.
We're already pointing it to the database. This is when you have a database already on your box.
Right.
We have the brains to figure out. If you have SQL, we go to SQL. If you have SQL Express, we go to SQL Express. If you don't have anything, then you need to type where you want to go.
Right, okay.
And I'm going to call this persistence DB.
Now, some people will be like, can I put them in the same database, the monitoring and persistence? Is that a good idea?
It is something that you can do. Yeah. However, they use different recovery settings for SQL.
Okay.
So one of them uses full recovery and the other one doesn't really care about recovery.
Right. So
it's just something to think about when you're...
You probably don't want to put them in the same then.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Now I noticed that on the authentication, this is a little different. The users is automatically the IIS users.
Right. Because that is a built-in account in Windows.
Yeah.
That it doesn't matter what identity your app pools is running.
Yeah.
It's going to be a member of this group.
Okay.
So that's how we simplify a little bit of, well, you can select a different user for the app pool.
Mm-hmm.
However, they all belong to this group.
Okay. All right, cool.
And behind the scenes is doing the initialization of the database, adds it to the config file.
Okay.
And it's done. So I'm going to click on next.
And when you said it adds it to the config file, you mean it puts it in the web config.
In the root web config.
In the root web config, right?
Right.
And so if you were in an environment where you said, well, for the root website, that's okay, but I have this other website a little further down. I want to use a different store.
Right.
You can configure just that one?
Yeah, but that you would use different tools. You would use the PowerShells.
Okay, so you can't do that with this tool, but okay.
So this is, we're talking system level settings.
Yeah.
So this is taking advantage of another thing that was introduced in .NET 4,
mm-hmm.
which is the nameless behavior.
Right.
So the idea is that you would have a bunch of databases register at the root.
Yeah.
And then you would just say which one you would be using in your behavior, or you can inherit the name of the behavior across the board.
Right. So in WCF and the workflows services and whatnot, they'll inherit these config settings
right.
further down, right?
Right.
Okay. But you can override them if you want.
Yeah, you can override them. And if you're a box owner, you can also prevent them from being overridden.
Oh, okay. All right. So, because there might be cases, particularly I imagine, like kind of hosting scenarios where you right. would want maybe different databases for different customers.
Right, and you want to make sure that this guy is using his database and not somebody else's.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent.
So, at this point, we're done with the hosting configuration.
Okay.
So, now comes the caching.
Right.
So this is a little bit different. There's more things to set here. So the first thing, we're opting in to configuring the cache.
Okay.
Because we're running in a domain.
Yeah.
This is the default identity that you want to use for the caching service. The caching service is configured out of the box to be working in a domain.
Yeah.
If we detect that you're in a workgroup scenario,
yeah.
then changing that identity would be supported through this UI.
Okay, because this came up for me today when I was setting up AppFabric in a virtual machine environment. And, of course, my virtual machine is not joined to a domain.
Right.
So I found that actually it didn't want to allow me to use network service. So in that case, I mean, I'm just using it for a single box just so you can do like a hands-on lab or something.
Right.
You would want to set that to local service.
You can use local service or any built-in account.
Right, right. Okay. So I just picked local service because that's easy. And that's what I went with. But all right. So then we have a config provider.
Right. And then, in this case, we have the two that we mentioned. There's XML and the one for SQL.
Yeah, and the thing about the XML provider, if you pick the XML one here so we can see what it does. So it says that it wants a UNC server share. So even if you think, I'm only running on a single box and I don't think I'll ever use this to connect to anybody else, you still have to share this folder?
You still have to point it to a shared folder.
Right, right. Okay, because it's going to insist on that.
Right.
Right, okay.
So the product is inherently distributed.
Right.
So it's optimized for those types of scenarios.
Yeah.
The single machine is a very limited demo purpose scenario, so.
Right, right. But for people who are just trying this out and they're just going to do it on one machine, I just want to be really clear. You will have to share a folder.
You would have to share a folder, right?
Okay.
Or if you have SQL Express, you can also point it to SQL Express.
Which might be easier if you're just doing one machine.
And that's what I want to do for this one. So in this case, I want to register the configuration database. That means I'm going to be using it in this machine.
Okay.
And I want to create the AppFabric caching service configuration database.
It's interesting. This one says create where the others say initialize.
Right.
But that's a little feedback for future. Okay. And so we just give it
so
a database.
Call it, caching. Oh, and something else that I want to show is if you click on the dropdown, it's going to tell you what's already there in the server.
See.
So if you point it to us to a particular server, it's going to tell you what's already there.
Okay.
So it takes away a little bit of the typing.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice.
So we click OK. And this will create the caching configuration database.
Okay. Excellent.
We're all done. And now, here's where we specify the settings that are going to go into that database.
Yeah.
So in this case, we're going to create a new cluster.
Right.
And we're going to pick the size.
Okay.
So size is something that also comes up. That it's a question.
Mm-hmm.
These sizes don't limit the number of machines that can be joined to a cluster.
Right.
But it has to do with the heuristics that go in how the information is distributed in the cluster.
Okay.
So it's optimized for 1 to 5 machines.
Right.
But you can have 6 or 7. So you need to think a little bit about what is the size of your cache going to be? How much demand?
And you could change this later if you decided it grew.
That is the problem, that you once you set it at the beginning, you cannot come back and reset it.
Oh.
Because the whole idea is you would have to take the cache offline. You would have to
reset it.
Right.
Okay, but if you really had to reset it, you'd take the cache offline, you reset it, and then bring it back.
Yeah, you would basically create a new cluster.
Oh,
and then join all the machines to that new, bigger cluster.
So I think some people would be tempted to just say, well, I'm going to go large because I don't know. But that's probably not a great idea.
So, you know, you need to think a little bit about how big is it going to be. Is it really going to be more than 15 machines?
Right.
It's very different when you go more than 15 than when you go 6 to 15. Than when you go, oh, I'm only going to have 2 or 3.
Well, I imagine that, you know, there's probably very few people are going to have cache clusters of 15 machines. It's probably very rare.
Right.
You know, most people I would imagine would be in the small category, actually.
Right.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. It's something to experiment with when you're doing your development and testing.
Right.
Okay.
So I'm going to set it to small.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to go click next. So what we did here is we set the, let's call it service level settings.
Mm-hmm.
So we created the configuration database.
Okay.
We told that database how big the cluster was going to be.
Yeah.
And now, because the caching service is installed on this machine,
right,
I also want to have the configuration for that machine.
Okay.
So I want to tell it, this machine is going to be communicating to the cluster over these ports. So this is where we get to...
Okay, so this is important because the caching service uses WCF with a TCP binding, and it's going to need ports to talk back and forth to the other machines in the cluster, and that's what you're doing here.
Right, and because you want to have that data that is replicated across several machines, and you want to have, you know, be able to distribute the information so that, you know, the information is hosted on the right machine.
Okay,
so. This is the cluster. This is the configuration ports that we use,
mm-hmm.
and we also need some firewall exceptions.
Okay.
So as you see, out of the box, we don't change the firewall settings.
Okay.
This is something that you're going to have to do either through config or manually.
Uh-huh.
We create a Windows firewall group,
right?
And just enabling disabling that group will be the equivalent of the first checkbox that we have here in the UI.
Okay. So if you don't do it now, it's not going to be a total pain to do it later.
Right.
Yeah, if you had to confer with the admin or something, you could do that later.
Right, right. And this is also important because in some cases, the firewall can be controlled by the main policy.
Right.
So you can go replicate the rule or export the rule, give it to your domain controller, and he can make a decision whether, okay, I'm going to allow it in these machines that are the domain machines that are running the cache cluster.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Now... the other thing, just so that people don't freak out about this, because I think it's a legitimate concern,
right?
Some security guys will be like, hey, what ports are you opening, and and who's listening, and who can call that, and how are we going to secure that?
Right.
So the cache service, you can secure who's able to call these, and it's using the encrypted, you know, good old message security and all that kind of stuff, right? So it's very... secure.
Yeah, as you said, the cache is basically built on top of WCF.
Yeah.
And you have the WCF transport encryption.
Okay.
So.
Yes, transport level security, right? That would make more sense here. So, but you can restrict what identities are allowed to call this.
Right.
So you can secure this. You can also turn off the security if you want to, if you decide you don't need it in your environment.
Right.
So that's up to you.
Right. And if you're configuring it on a single box, you don't even have to think about this.
Correct.
Okay. So you can keep your box secure,
but
the cache will work because it's just going through the loopback.
Right, right. Okay, excellent.
So just for demonstration purposes, I'm going to enable it. Oh, and this is the remote service management.
Mm-hmm.
This is a built-in Windows firewall security exception.
Oh, okay.
So this is done because when you're running a cluster of several machines, then the machines can be controlled by the cluster and the service will want to start the service, stop the service dynamically.
Oh, okay.
So this is done. This is what allows us to do that on the box.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
So during configuration, once you go into management of the cluster, you would call a command, for example, start cache cluster.
Yeah.
And that would go to each of the machines that are part of that cluster and start the service.
Oh, okay. Well, that's cool. All right. That's good to know.
Then this will apply the cluster settings. And at that point, you're done with the cache configuration.
Okay.
So now the next logical step is, go to IIS to configure your applications to use the new functionality that we have exposed.
Ah, okay.
And that's why we have this link.
And just to be clear, so that people don't get the wrong idea, there's no setting in IIS that says, like, use the cache with my website.
You know, right.
There's nothing like that. I mean, you know, it's a little more complicated than that. You have to make, you have to code some things. You have to configure some things.
There's the cache client, mm-hmm. which is a bunch of DLLs that you would be using when you're writing your application.
Right.
And you're writing against the caching API.
This is a very good point, because in the typical, like, a web scenario, if I got some web servers and I've got some cache servers, I don't need to put the cache service on my web servers. In fact, right. I don't want to.
You don't want to.
I put the cache client there, and then on my cache servers, I put just the cache service.
Correct.
Right, so the default setting I noticed for the web server was to not install the cache service.
Right.
In fact, it would be kind of unusual to have the host and the cache service together at the same place. Right.
So you want to have it separated, because the cache is a very greedy service, right?
It's trying
to take over the machine. It's trying to take over as much RAM as possible so that it's available to the cache.
Right.
And then you would have it competing with anything else that you're running on that box.
Okay. Excellent. Well, dude, this is awesome. It's exciting. We've been waiting a long time for Beta 2 to arrive. I think it was, almost a year ago when we sat here in the studio and had this kind of what is Dublin talk and a bunch of stuff like that. It's finally, you know, coming here where people can get it and use it. So it's so exciting to see it. Good job on the setup, by the way.
Thank you.
I love it. I think we've made great progress there. So let me encourage you to go and pick up App Fabric Beta 2. You can get it from the easiest way, of course, is with the web platform installer. If you want to walk through that experience, that was totally painless. If you got to be, you know, more hardcore and you want to get the MSI, you can go to the App Fabric Developer Center on MSDN, msdn.microsoft.com/appfabric. I'm sure we'll have a nice big download link there. You'll find it on the download center. So get it, give it a try. We'll have more about App Fabric and ways you can learn from it, use it, and build it in your applications. So we'll see you next time on Endpoint TV.